Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Sarah DeBacher and Abram Himmelstein about a new book, When I Was Your Age. We'll also hear from Renee Steinke, whose most recent novel is Friendswood. It's a great pleasure to welcome Sarah DeBacher, who directs the freshman writing program here at the University of New Orleans, as well as the Greater New Orleans Writing Project, and Abram Himmelstein of the Neighborhood Story Project. We're celebrating a new book from the Neighborhood Story Project, and it's called When I Was Your Age, and it's a book by the teachers of Andrew Wilson Charter School. The book will be making its debut on a panel April 18th at Write Fest. So, Sarah, when you first told me about this book, you said that this was a school that had been going through some hard times. Tell us a little bit about those hard times.
The Greater New Orleans Writing Project has worked with Andrew Wilson for several years, and it's a really great school. The teachers love their students. The administration really supports the teachers. Earlier this year, three of the students that attended the school and who lived very close to the campus, in fact, immediately adjacent to the campus, were killed in a tragic house fire. And they're also, of course, going through a transition as Andrew Wilson closes and is taken over by the Inspire NOLA Charter School Network. So any kind of transition, I think, is difficult for any human being, but particularly for a school and for the teachers. There's a lot of difficulty as they make their way into that new school or wherever they may land.
So that's a big loss of friends of the school they knew and loved. So that is a huge, huge change. So what did you hope to accomplish with this book?
Well, the National Writing Project really believes that in order to teach writing, teachers need themselves to be writers. So our first goal, our first objective is really to support the teachers in becoming strong advocates for their students, strong advocates of writing, and in becoming writers themselves. Of course, there's also my personal belief that writing is a really healing and cathartic process. And so, you know, these things hadn't happened prior to our beginning the work on this book. The objective of the book was really one that was tied to professional development, that was tied to a grant from the National Writing Project to support professional development in a high-needs school and to support teachers in becoming writers so that they could tap into the lives of their students in a meaningful way and really write beside them as opposed to telling them how to write, if that right. makes any sense.
It's good when everybody writes together,
yeah.
I think.
Yeah.
Now, Abram, whenever I think of the Neighborhood Story Project, I think of your mantra, you know, our stories told by us. And so many times in your books, it's been the students telling the stories, and this time the teachers tell the stories. So tell us about how the book turned out in the end.
That was, I think, one of the things Sarah and I were really excited were for teachers to get the chance to be full human beings. I think a lot of times, I know when I was a kid, I thought the teachers lived at school to the point that I would be shocked when I saw them elsewhere. You know, I'd see them at the grocery store and literally just be unable to speak. I was so surprised. And so I think that a lot of what this does is allows, one, teachers to be writers in front of their students, but it also allows teachers to be full human beings in front of their students. And so the students get to see their teachers as someone who was in second grade and who struggled with second grade and who is able then to be trusted with their struggles as a second grader. And so I hope that it does the work of really building the community at that school and letting people bring more of their humanity into the classroom, the kids being more present, the teachers being more present.
And I think it also allows the students to trust their teachers with their writing because writing, you know, so often when we write about ourselves and about our lives, it can, you know, we tap into so many emotions. Very often students do that. You know, there's this quote unquote just for the teacher sense of an audience. When the teacher becomes a full human being, I think that the students can begin to really trust them with their writing, which is really important in the classroom.
Now, the other great thing about this book, well, it's great and it's kind of sad at the same time, is that it reminds the average reader, myself here, that some problems in school life are kind of eternal. People will call you names. There will be bullying, sadly. You'll have trouble getting, you know, your family life and your school life together. But somehow you'll get through it and you'll come out the other side, which is kind of the wonderful message of this. And I wonder if you've had any student reactions to these essays. I mean, in that they've learned something about their teacher from them.
I have used my essay about my name, my last name.
I know we should be calling you Hip Hop DeBarker now, right?
That's right. Thank you for using that instead of Sarah DeBarfer. But I have used that essay with my freshmen here at the University of New Orleans, and I use it very early on in the semester. And I really do believe in that notion of writing beside my students. And so on the first day of class, I invite them to write about their own names, and I write about my name. We read a piece from Sandra Cisneros' book, The House on Mango Street. And it's a really great community building exercise because, yeah, I've been able to share with them the fact that I have been tortured by my last name. And so many of my students have reported to me, oh, so have I, you know, and through the specificity of their own last names and their own storytelling, we really get to come together. I mean, it's kind of awesome.
And that's how we start the first day of school, learning each other's names.
Right.
I mean, it's just a basic, basic thing. Now, Abram, your story, Cool Cats, told about a different sort of experience. I wonder if you'd talk about your piece.
So my story, I actually had to tell my parents before I published it, but my story is the story of a lie I told when I was a kindergartner. And so it began with me very innocently trying to return an amazing drawing to my table mate in kindergarten. And when he said, no, no, my mom has too many of my drawings, I ended up with the most sublime picture tucked in my backpack. And so when I got home, my mom opened the backpack and she's, wow, Abram, you really can draw. And she thought this was this hidden talent that I was just now showing. And so, you know, sometimes a lie is easier than the truth. And for a five-year-old me, that was the case. And so I let my mom believe that I had done this amazing drawing and thinking it would go on the fridge or something probably. But my mom surprised me by framing it in a way that I am putting it on the wall and leaving it up really for the next 8 years until during a move, I couldn't stand looking at it anymore and I threw it away. So the lie really was in my face for 8 years. And I felt like that's also one of the things that we learn while growing up are these kind of life lessons, and that, you know, I wanted to present myself as somebody who was emerging into a better self during my school years and not somebody who came fully cognizant of my morals. Like, I definitely, my morals were a work in progress. I'd like to think that I've congealed towards the better end of the spectrum, but definitely in my elementary days, my morals were what I was learning.
Yeah, so you're learning them every day.
Yeah.
I also liked it that you pointed out that you were better at writing than coloring, as
yes.
I was. So I felt very sympathetic towards you. Oh, now you're going to unveil this book at WriteFest this weekend, April 18th. So tell us what's going on there.
WriteFest is an all-day conference. It's a professional development conference for teachers who want to use writing in their classrooms at any grade level and any subject area. This year is really exciting because we're hosting the National Writing Project's Urban Sites Network. So we have 16 breakout sessions. 13 of them feature National Writing Project teacher consultants who are, you know, teachers who are using writing successfully in their classrooms. And so all of these teachers are coming here and they're going to be talking about the ways in which writing has, again, built community and fostered student voice and made teachers and students both mutually more human. And our panel will celebrate the process of writing this book with the teachers. It will celebrate some of the really great pieces that are in the book, but it will also allow the teachers who attend to write from that perspective of, you know, when they were the age of their students. Because I think just as, you know, it makes the teacher more human for the students, it allows us to tap into the experiences of our students in a way that I think is really important.
And you're taking them to some really great places around town when they're here, aren't you?
Oh, yeah. On Friday, we've got a French Quarter writing marathon that's going to be hosted by Richard Luth. And we have a map of literary sites around the quarter that teachers can visit and write and perhaps drink at. Abram's going to be leading a bus tour that explores the post-K educational climate in New Orleans. We have a wonderful celebration on Friday night at Press Street in partnership with Big Class and the Pizza Poetry Party. And then Saturday, we have the all-day conference with two amazing keynote speakers. So it's going to be great.
It is going to be great. You're taking people to the House of Dance and Feathers and all around town. It's just a great, great thing you're doing. So where can people go for more information about this book?
They can visit the Greater New Orleans Writing Project website, which is at www.gnowp.org. We call it GNOWP, but GNOWP. And they can register for the conference there. And we do hope to have some other events or some other celebrations associated with this book. But we also hope that we'll see lots of people at WriteFest.
And Abram, will this book be available in local bookstores too, like the other Neighborhood Story Project books?
Yeah, this book will be available hopefully at all the local independent bookstores. So
great.
Yes.
Because it really takes you right inside the life of a school. It's just invaluable and lovely and heartwarming and all the things it should be, you know? Well, thank you so much. We've been talking with Sarah Hip Hop DeBacher of the Greater New Orleans Writing Project and Abram Himmelstein of the Neighborhood Story Project about the new book, When I Was Your Age. For more information about WriteFest, which takes place this weekend at the University of New Orleans, check out gnowp.org. Thank you so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
You too, Abram.
Thank you.
Renee Steinke is the author of Fires, the National Book Award finalist Holy Skirts, and her most recent book is Friendswood, about life in a small Texas town. It's about to come out in paperback just in time for summer reading. Renee is the director of the creative writing program at Fairleigh Dickinson University, and she's speaking to us from her home in Brooklyn. Hi, Renee. Welcome to The Reading Life.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Now, one of the things I love about your work is that you always do something different. Your first book, Fires, took us into the mind of a pyromaniac, and Holy Skirts, which I adored, took us back to the life of Baroness Elsa von Freytag-Loringhoven, a controversial figure from the 20s, and now Friendswood, a contemporary novel set in the Texas town where you grew up. So what made you decide that the time was right to kind of go home in Friendswood?
I think I needed the distance to be able to return to that territory. I like to start with a place when I begin a novel, and the characters tend to grow out of that place. So even though in Holy Skirts I was writing about, you know, a character from history, I was writing largely about Greenwich Village, where I lived at the time. And Friendswood is where I grew up. And around the time the novel started bubbling up for me, there was a lot of talk about Texas and Brooklyn, because George Bush was president, and there were a lot of misconceptions about Texas in those days, at least especially here. And I think I wanted to write about the complexities of the place and the nuances and the textures, and something about that drew me to writing about Texas.
Now, Texan or no, this is a novel that everyone on the Gulf Coast can identify with. So tell us a little bit about the problems that exist in Friendswood.
Well, this is really a novel about how a community deals with a disaster. In this case, it's a toxic leak, industrial leak. And I wanted to look at how a community survives that, what happens after the media storm leaves, and really just look at how it affects people's individual lives. Like, what happens to the kids who still have to go to high school after something like this happens? What happens to marriages, to love affairs, to churches, to businesses? And the story is inspired by something that actually happened in my town, which is that a neighborhood was built too close to a field where there had been an old oil refinery and chemicals had been dumped for decades. And people in this subdivision began to get very sick. Babies were born with birth defects at a rate much higher than the national average, and took a while for the authorities to believe that this was actually happening. But once people recognized the dangers, the neighborhood was literally razed. All those homes were bulldozed. So I was really fascinated, and I really wanted to think about how a small community, which values so much its sense of home, deals with an event like this. So much shakes your sense of safety.
I know what you mean. I grew up in Texas City, which is very close to Friendswood. And,
right. You
know, that's a town that's famous for its disasters. So, I mean, I laugh, but that's kind of what you do, you know, because the whole town blew up in 1947. So it is. It is that kind of bizarre sense of being unsafe at some one of the most basic human levels.
Yeah. You know, when I grew up in Friendswood, I love Friendswood, by the way. I think mm-hmm. It's a really original and tight community. I have a lot of friends there. But even while we were growing up there, my brothers and sisters and I had a very strong sense that we were growing up alongside the oil industry. And, you know, sometimes that was just kind of a novelty. Like, we used to ride our bikes through the oil fields.
Yep.
And we used to find all kinds of strange equipment or pieces of equipment on the golf course, which was right next to the oil fields. But later on, after I left Friendswood, I've heard, unfortunately, about a lot of my friends who've gotten sick. A few friends have died of brain tumors. And, you know, there's no way to know whether or not this was actually caused by living next to the oil fields or not. But that sense of anxiety about the environment, I think, is a very contemporary fear, not just in Texas or the Southeast, but actually, you know, everywhere in America at this point.
Right. Now, you capture a lot of the institutions of small towns, you know, the big business that is the economic engine, the school, the church, the bars, that kind of thing. Tell us about, you know, kind of constructing Friendswood as you remember it and as it is in this novel.
Oh, the Friendswood in the novel is a fictional Friendswood. It's somewhere between the Friendswood of my youth, which was more rural, and the Friendswood of today, which has become more suburban. And there are some imagined, I definitely changed the names of certain businesses that I've depicted and changed the names of streets because I wanted it to be very clear that this was an alternate Friendswood, not in any kind of nonfiction depiction of the town.
Right. And tell us about the characters. Lee Knowles, particularly, I think a lot of women will identify with so powerfully.
Well, Lee is a very fierce, middle-aged divorcee who lost her daughter to a horrible disease. And she'll do anything for what she thinks is right. And she's trying to fight a developer who wants to build basically right on the same site where the toxins were first discovered. And unbelievably, the permits are going forward, and she is trying to fight that. And, you know, she's very fierce and determined, driven by grief, but also a sense of justice. But she also likes to drink bourbon and sing along to the radio with her friends.
And so, she has a great friend named Rush.
Yeah.
I love her friend.
Yeah, Rush, too.
I bet she was a lot of fun to write.
Yeah, Rush keeps trying to sort of calm Lee down and tries to get her to let go a little bit and have fun, not always successfully.
Right. And then you've written about a young girl who is so incredibly moving. Willa, tell us about her.
Willa is a teenage girl who has visions, and those visions sort of, they take on an apocalyptic character after she is sexually assaulted at a party. And she was raised by fundamentalist Christians, and that she's sort of rebelling against that and trying to figure out what she believes. And she's also sort of obsessed with Emily Dickinson and the Alamo and Joan of Arc.
That's a wonderful combination, you know, when you think about it. I'm trying to remember what I was obsessed with when I was her age. I think Emily Dickinson might have figured in there. But the Alamo is a very powerful thing for all Texans, you know? So this book has been out for a while. So what reaction did you get from your hometown readers?
you know, it's been very positive. There's a lot of hometown pride, and even though I think I'm telling a story that's, you know, a sad part of the town's past, I've been getting incredibly letters from the people who lived in South Bend, which is the inspiration for Rosemont, the neighborhood in my book, and saying, you know, they're so glad someone is telling the story. I went to Friendswood for homecoming, and I was sitting, you know, in the front watching the game and, you know, watching the pageantry, which was really fun for me. I hadn't been to a high school football game in decades.
Oh, wow.
And I heard behind me this voice saying, "I heard you wrote a book." And there was one of my friend's mothers there. So people in Friendswood are, I think, happy to see the town depicted. And, you know, I think they recognize that there's a certain resilience in these characters that is recognizable.
Well, I think it'll certainly be recognizable to New Orleanians. You've got a hurricane in here, too.
That's right. That's right. Not as major as Katrina, of course, but we had hurricanes all the time.
Oh, yeah.
There in Friendswood. So that memory was very formative for me.
So have you found the place for your next book yet?
I'm not positive, but I'm starting to fool around with the idea of a story set at the border of Texas and Mexico.
Whoa, that's fertile ground. That could be really interesting. Girl, go back to Texas.
Well, you know, it's a landscape that literature hasn't fully, or at least contemporary literature hasn't really fully explored.
And it's a fascinating landscape to me. I mean, I grew up there too, so I know what you mean. Something else.
Yeah, where we grew up, really, Southeast Texas is so different from Panhandle, which is so different from Beaumont, Port Arthur, the Mary Carr land. And,
yeah.
You know, each of the cities is so different.
Well, I can't wait to see what you do next. It's been so interesting. So what are you teaching now? What are you teaching at Fairleigh Dickinson?
Well, at this very moment, I'm on sabbatical, which is wonderful. So I'm, for the first time in my life, I have a few months just to write. Mm-hmm. But normally I teach fiction writing and literature.
Well, all right. We've been talking with novelist Renee Steinke, who will be reading from Friendswood and discussing that book Thursday, April 16th at 5:30 at the Liberal Arts Building, Room 140 here at the University of New Orleans. Renee, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan, so much. It was a pleasure.
Poetry lends itself to melody so easily. Stevie Nicks draws from the work of Edgar Allan Poe for the lovely Annabel Lee from the album In Your Dreams. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Poets Megan Burns and Gina Ferrara read Tuesday, April 14th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library. The Friends of the New UNO Library hold their used book sale Tuesday, April 14th and Wednesday, April 15th on the fourth floor of the Earl K. Long Library. Michael Martin discusses and signs Russell Long, A Life in Politics, Wednesday, April 15th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. Today's guest, Renee Steinke, reads from and discusses Friendswood, Thursday, April 16th at 5:30 at the University of New Orleans in the Liberal Arts Building, Room 140. Jamie Cornegay discusses and signs his novel Soil, Thursday, April 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Michael Petrie, author of Fives and 25s, interviews Cornegay following the reading. Gina Ferrara hosts Poets Reading, Poets Reading, Saturday, April 18th at 2 at the Latter Library. Bring two poems by your favorite poet to read or just come listen. Novelist L. Kevin Coleman presents his book Different Springs, along with a flamenco guitar and dance presentation, Saturday, April 18th at 6 at Octavia Books. Shannon Abel signs Choosing the Simply Luxurious Life, A Modern Woman's Guide, Sunday, April 19th from 2 to 4 at Garden District Bookshop. New York Times bestselling author David Baldacci signs Memory Man, his 30th novel for adults, Tuesday, April 21st at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And Steve Beisner, writer, musician, and computer scientist, discusses new software that's useful to writers, Tuesday, April 21st at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. This is the meeting of the Women's National Book Association of New Orleans, and all are welcome. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.